from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Can a New York hot dog make it in L.A.? We'll find out today on the show. Eating salad for dinner. Eric Greenspan's here with the secret to his killer fried chicken, plus an in-depth look at the controversial practice of fracking and what it does to our food and water. And we'll go out to eat in Orange County. But first, let's find out what's fresh and in season this week with Laura Avery, who's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's always good to catch up with chefs that we don't get much of a chance to visit with. And we're talking today with Elon Hall, who is the founding chef and owner of a restaurant called The Gorbals. So, Elon, you're going to explain to us where that name came from. And also, I notice here that your stroller is just festooned with bags, one of which carries absolute copious amounts of beautiful squash blossoms.
My restaurant, The Gorbals, in downtown Los Angeles, it's named after the neighborhood that my father grew up in Glasgow, Scotland, and sort of this immigrant neighborhood where he was born and sort of rough and now is a bit fancy and nice. It's been revamped, kind of like downtown Los Angeles.
In Glasgow, Scotland.
Yeah, in Glasgow.
Place
yeah.
to go next time we're there.
Yeah. No,
okay.
It's good fun. Cool. So these squash blossoms that I've got, we're going to do two things with them. We use them in our fresh... Oh, that's my son, Theo. he wants to talk about it. We use them for our fresh matzah dish. We're going to saute them with fresh peas and garbanzo beans and put them over matzah that we grill, fresh matzah dough that we do on the plancha, and then with a little bit of hummus, very simple, and then we grate raw horseradish on top.
Do you try really to keep fresh. The blossoms intact, during, or do you just chop them up?
No, the blossoms I keep totally intact because they wilt a lot when you saute them. We just we saute them really quickly, get a little bit of color on them, and then just get them in with all that stuff.
Do you try to take out that little stem thing in the middle, or just leave that in?
I like the stem. I like all of it. I mean, the whole thing is pretty tasty. And then we deep fry them. We sort of, lightly fry them. What does that mean? We dip them in batter and we fry them, and then we pour spicy honey over them.
Oh,
they're very delicious.
And what kind of batter? Is it like a real light,
like a
tempura
like a thin? Like a thin, thin tempura batter.
Uh-huh.
It's not nothing new,
so
but it's just good, you know?
Do you have to trim the end, though, the end where the stem actually was?
No, actually, I don't trim it at all. I use those to help dip, and when they're fried, they're really tasty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you could fry my son's toes, and they'll be really tasty.
Anything fried is good.
Yes.
And those are those a special order? Because that's a lot of squash blossoms.
No, you just, there's one of the farms, Valdivia Farms, at the beginning, the entrance to the market.
Yeah.
They run... Theo, come on. They run out of them at about 10 o'clock, so if you get here early enough, you can get them.
All right, Elon. Well, thank you so much. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you, Theo.
Thank you so much.
All right. Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
That was Elon Hall, who, did I mention he was a Top Chef winner in 2007? And now he's got this wonderful restaurant called The Gorbals, and he is here with his adorable son, Theo, and he's going to be creating some wonderful dishes with these gorgeous squash blossoms. One of the things that we stress a lot at the farmers market is seasonality. And there are certain things that I'm always kind of surprised to know that there's a season for. Like, I'm always surprised when suddenly there's no limes. And people say, you know, limes have a season. Garlic is another crop that, you know, you don't miss it until it's gone. Barbara Spencer is a farmer from Paso Robles, from Windrose Farm. And Barbara, you literally now have sort of perfected the art of growing garlic. And you actually have a whole array of different kinds of garlic. So tell us about your garlic program and what kind of garlics you're growing.
Okay, we grow probably 15 varieties now of different garlics. The easiest way to start with is we do not grow California white. We started growing, you know, because so many things we do are like the heirloom old varieties and stuff. So we started growing some of the older garlics and finding they were spectacular. So basically all ours come under the heading of being purple garlics, purple or reds, and some hardneck, which is types grown in colder climates usually. And those are the ones that make the garlic scapes, those funny little things that come out around May.
Things.
Those curly
mm-hmm.
things that you fry. Anyway, we've ended up growing more and more different kinds every year. And what's really fun is that different ones do different things. Some are better for roasting. Some are better for actually chopping up and sauteing and things like that. So, and garlic on our farm, we harvest in June. and we're finishing the cleaning and the curing now. And what happens is now and then the beginning of August is when it has its most distinctive flavors between the varieties. So we're just getting to the point when someone can really come and try different ones and have them be different from each other.
And they harden off, right? I mean, they grow underground, and then when you want that bulb to get nice and dry and get the skin to get all flaky.
You're going to pull it before it gets really dry.
Okay,
because,
when is that?
Well, you'll start to see, okay, because you've got the bulb forming underneath, you've got the stalk coming up, and you start to see four or so leaves start to dry off. And when they dry off is when you start poking around and seeing if the head is ready to be pulled. You don't want to wait till it starts falling over and stuff like that, because then you've lost some of the skins. You really don't want to have the ones where they're exploding, the clothes are exploding
out of
the head.
Which is what me at home, when I'm peeling all that skin off and making a mess, is what I don't want to have, is all those layers of skin. I like those cloves just popping out with
that's
no skin.
But yes,
that's a nightmare for you.
Big picture and quality of the garlic itself, how long it'll hold. Yes, it's easy, but it's not the best thing. I mean, left out on a counter hung, all that stuff will continue to cure. If you put it in the fridge, it'll mold, which is so you don't want to do that.
Right.
You want to leave it out in a dry, cool place to dry. Like 60 degrees is perfect, that kind of thing. And it'll just continue to be okay.
So, Barbara, what would be a good variety for roasting?
One of the best ones is what's called Kettle River. It comes from up north, and it's just a great, great milder, rich, sweet garlic. And we have one client who takes it and roasts it, and just he serves it as a head with bread to his customers.
You just smear it on the
restaurant.
Bread.
Just, here, go ahead. Just squirt it out and go for it. Yeah.
Oh, you squeeze the roasted garlic out of the paper skin.
And just spread
right
it on the bread.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds so good.
It is good.
Oh,
really
yeah. Okay, well, this is great. Now, you're at the Wednesday Santa Monica, and then that's it.
That's it. We are at home on the farm the rest of the time and doing chef deliveries and hopefully getting back in a couple of markets in our county.
Uh-huh.
We decided it's time to be more local
spread
with that end
joy.
Of it. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Barbara. Well, thanks. Your stand, by the way, I mean, just it's so picturesque every week. Just
thank
fun.
You.
It's just a treat to come down here and see it.
Thank you.
All right.
It's our pleasure.
That was Barbara Spencer, and she and her husband Bill owned Windrose Farm up in Paso Robles, and she is a grower of 15 different kinds of garlic. So come on down and check them out. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
I've got a recipe for roasted garlic on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're listening to this show live Saturday morning at 11 a.m., then it's not too late for you to check out the Eat Real Festival at Helms Bakery in Culver City. It's a celebration of handcrafted, sustainably produced food. There's still time to check out the butchery competition, live music performances, KCRW DJs, and my tomato sauce demo. Of course, there's loads of yummy food trucks and vendors. That's the Eat Real Fest at Helms Bakery this Saturday and Sunday. Here in Southern California, we have the luxury of being able to eat fresh salad all year round. It's not unusual for salad to make up an entire meal for us. My guest today is noted cookbook author Patricia Wells. She lives in France, where she holds cooking classes and writes about food. Her latest book is Salad as a Meal.
First of all, I have to give you the definition of a salad. A salad doesn't have to include greens and, I mean, it can, of course, and that's what we all think of as, you know, lettuce and so on and so forth. But a salad can be so many things. For instance, a fish salad can be a sashimi kind of salad with some vegetables. A chicken salad can be so many things. I think that we have to expand our horizons in thinking about really what a salad can be. And I'm a runner, and I'm always looking for lean protein to fill me up, to satisfy me, but so that when I get up from the table, I feel satisfied, not stuffed. And I think that's, you know, I think that's one of the keys to salad as a meal, is that it can be really light. It doesn't have to, but it can be delicious. I mean, there's so many variations, just endless.
Let's talk for a minute about sardines.
Yes, I know. You know, it's so funny. You're going to laugh because every time I serve sardines in my class, my husband said, people don't really like sardines. Well, I think the truth is that we think, you know, first of all, we think of them in a can. But you are in California, and you can get fresh sardines. And fresh sardines are so fabulous. And, you know, they're not only good for us, but they're good for the ecology. They grow really fast. they're easy, they're cheap. So when you do find fresh sardines in the market, I think you have to go for it. And there's so many things you can do. When you get them fresh on the market, you pull off their heads, pull out the insides, open them up like a book, scatter them with a little salt and herbs and let them sit for a few minutes, a little oil, and they are so delicious.
Just raw?
Just raw. They're so good for you, and they're so delicious. But, look, you have to go for it. What I like to do is just a little bit of salt, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of vinegar. I can eat them right away, but if you want to have them, more ceviche-like, you might let them sit in the refrigerator for 10 or 15 minutes. And then just whatever herbs you have in the garden. I mean, I'm just sort of been in this mood where I've got whatever I can find, I just shower on it. I mean, you don't have to. I mean, mint is, we all forget about mint as a great fresh herb. Mint and basil and thyme and coriander. You can put all these things together, and they each one is sort of like a little symphony of flavors and shouting out its little best part of itself.
I also understand that you are a big proponent of using a small stovetop smoker with fish.
I love it, and it's great. I mean, I have done just about everything. I mean, I've done sardines, I've done anchovies. Obviously, we do shellfish too. Scallop roe, if you can get scallop roe, is fabulous. And it doesn't make things taste smoked.
So once you have your smoked chicken or your smoked fish, give us some ideas for then how we can turn it into a beautiful center of the plate.
Okay, one other thing, trout is also fabulous, and mackerel. And I know people go, mackerel, that's another fish that we forget about. It's so inexpensive, it's delicious. So what I would do, for instance, with any of the small fish, sardines, anchovies, mackerel, trout, open it up like a book. You can bone it or not. With mackerel, what I love to do is slather it with coarse mustard and black peppercorns. It's delicious. And you just open it up like a book, smoke it 5 to 7 minutes, and put it on top of a green salad or with a salad alongside. They're just endless possibilities, really.
And then for a more traditional sort of flaked smoked fish salad, like using trout or whitefish, something like that, take us through one of your dishes.
Well, what you could do there is, flake the fish. I have many, many different dressings in the book. One of my favorites is very simple, light cream and lemon juice and some herbs, especially chives. So you make a dressing of, say, 4 tablespoons of light cream, a tablespoon of lemon juice, lots of chives. Toss that with the smoked fish. Put that on a bed of greens. There's just lots of things you can do with it.
That's so interesting. So basically, it's something that it's not a mayonnaise, and it's not a proper vinaigrette.
No, neither. I think that people are looking for something that's quite flavorful, and I have found that either using light cream, hopefully if you can find something organic that has a lot of flavor, I find half and half is sort of bland, but okay. I'll settle for that. You can put a little fine sea salt in that and boost the flavor a lot. Good freshly squeezed lemon juice and lots of herbs. And you can toss that with your poached chicken or smoked chicken breast, any of the fish. But also the same thing with yogurt. You can make a really lovely dressing with yogurt. I would suggest you use a full-fat yogurt, because sometimes the low-fat yogurts are just a little bit too wimpy and don't have enough flavor. So just 4 tablespoons of yogurt, a tablespoon of lemon juice, and lots of herbs, and you've got a dressing that's fabulous. The other thing I use a lot is tahini, sesame paste, and lemon juice are a fabulous combination for a dressing for something like a chicken salad. I think it's a little bit strong for a fish salad.
Take us through how to make the perfect poached chicken breast, since they tend to be, a poached chicken breast is just like a blank canvas for salads.
Well, I find the best way is to either start with a chicken stock or make a stock on your own with lots of herbs. Poach the chicken breast for about 15 minutes in that liquid, turn off the heat and let it rest so it stays nice and moist. and then take it out and slice the chicken. You know, just let it rest a bit, and you've got a great chicken breast for your salads.
Are you actually simmering the chicken breasts at all?
Just a little bit, just a little bit. But I think that it's, you know, if you bring it to a boil, put in the chicken breast, and let it rest, you've got a really nice, moist, not too firm breast.
I love that kind of recipe. It's sort of like a non-recipe recipe.
Well, the best recipes are non-recipes. And I always tell my students, every recipe, you know, is a work in progress. And, you know, almost every time I make something, I change it a little bit. And that is one frustrating thing, as I'm sure you know, about writing cookbooks. And you look at something and say, well, I don't quite make it exactly that way anymore. But, you know, you do have to give people, but you have to make people understand that every recipe is a work in progress and that you have to put a little bit of sense into everything you do.
I've been talking with Patricia Wells. Her new book is Salad as a Meal. When Good Food returns, I'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold. He's here to review the latest New York to LA transplant, Papaya King. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. Time now for Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're hearing about the newest New York to LA transplant, Papaya King.
We are going to the first Los Angeles branch of the prominent New York hot dog chain, Papaya King.
Do you like Papaya King hot dogs in situ, where they were born, in New York?
I'm always more of a Gray's papaya man myself. I mean, like, when I lived in New York, I lived to the Village. You know, there's Gray Papaya right there on 6th Avenue and 8th. And you would go there all the time.
Now, describe the linkage of the hot dog with papaya.
As far as I know this, Papaya King started as a juice stand that had papaya drinks. And there's all these things on the walls, both here in New York, about the miracle, you know, enzymatic properties of papaya and how it's going to make you live forever and make your teeth sparkle and your children brimming with good health. And as I suppose the juice bar was probably a hard sell, you know, back in the 30s when this was open, there's also hot dogs.
I love it. I love the pairing. It's sort of like destroy your digestive system with a hot dog and then repair it with papaya juice.
Exactly. Or coconut champagne. You can't overlook the coconut champagne.
Which is?
Some kind of coconut juicy thing.
Okay.
You can have a pina colada. You can have any number of 50s era juice drinks.
That's fantastic. So from the lines that I've seen just driving by on Wilcox, it seems that there is no dearth of Papaya King fans here in L.A.
No, it's a direct connection to New York. And as we know, there is no shortage of New Yorkers in Los Angeles willing to proclaim to everybody that everything in the Five Boroughs is better than anything in L.A. That is the natural audience for Papaya King, I think.
Describe the actual dog.
It is a dog. It has a natural casing. There's a snap to it. Garlicky juice. It is probably less distinctive than, say, a Vienna dog from Chicago, but it's distinctly its thing. In New York, or at least at Gray's Papaya, because I've got to say that's where 99% of my papaya dog experience happens in New York. The dogs are on grills and they have sort of a Christmas to them. Here, the dogs are on this endless succession of those motorized hot dog rollers like you used to see in movie theaters everywhere.
So it's sort of grilling light.
Right. I mean, you will not see any dark marks. You will not see any bits of char. You will not see any lines. You will see
like glistening
fat, taut hot dogs. And they will be in a bun that is just slightly, ever so slightly crisp on the grill. It will probably come with the classic New York hot dog condiment, which is onions cooked down with tomato sauce until it becomes an oniony tomato sauce. If you've had a hot dog in New York at any one of the 400 million Sabrettes carts, you will be intimately familiar.
It's ubiquitous.
Yes. You can get other things, of course, too. I mean, they have sauerkraut. It's not the best sauerkraut you've ever eaten. In fact, it's probably not even up to the sauerkraut at Pink's, but it's sauerkraut nonetheless. And if you have the sauerkraut and the ubiquitous New York onions, then you will have a New York onion kraut dog.
There you go.
There's chili in its basic form.
Slop form.
Yes. And sautéed onions and peppers in probably not the form that you would get it at Italian sausage stands, but it's in that direction. And that's it. That's your basic Papaya King experience.
No fries.
There are fries. They have big curly fries that are seasoned that come in paper cups and look absolutely tremendous and somehow don't have that.
They don't live up to the expectation.
They don't live up to the expectations. They don't have like that crispy on the outside, melty on the inside. They look great. I mean, if you take a picture of these fries, you will say, I have taken a picture of some fries, my friend. But when you eat them, perhaps they're not the fries you have in mind. And you can get, you know, specialty dogs, like a sausage that is more or less like a bigger hot dog. The seasoning isn't much that different. You can get, you know, chili and cheese and something ominously called, I've never seen one or tasted one. The name of it was enough, but the ominously named Beefinator.
That's scary to me.
It comes with meat sauce. Somebody will have to tell me what a Beefinator tastes like because that is something empirical evidence is just not going to happen.
You could face it on that day.
But, you know, you can get a papaya drink and you can have coconut champagne and it's, you know, really cheap. And, you know, you're more or less happy if you're looking for a New York Frank experience. It's owned by one of the big nightclub czars, or the one out here is. And it's supposed to be like frontage to some, you know, big fancy exclusive club that neither you and I are ever going to go to.
But I would imagine that they do a lot of business out at night late during the clubbing hours.
They do. They're open until 3 a.m. And if you've had a belly full of whatever you have a belly full of, then the Papaya King will do its yeoman duty to soak up those, you know, excess carbon compounds so that you may drive safely.
Perfect. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to restaurant critic Jonathan Gold about Papaya King on Wilcox Avenue near Hollywood Boulevard. Get the exact address sent to your cell phone. Just text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to 69866. And all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions continue to be on our good food restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know, in the crazy world, which is the restaurant business, it's always good to have a couple of friends who are super enthusiastic about what they do and always manage to make you laugh. Eric Greenspan is such a person to me. Eric is the chef of the Foundry on Melrose, and his ebullient hilarity when it comes to everything related to food and the restaurant business is very well known in our community. Hi.
Hello.
You know, it's summer, and of course, everybody knows I'm crazed for pie during the summer, but you have to eat something before.
Yeah.
And fried chicken.
Yeah.
perfect thing.
Summertime.
Take on a picnic.
Yeah.
I always think it's really funny, though, that, you know, both pie and fried chicken, while you're in the kitchen making it, it's really hot.
Yeah. It's super hot. And also the things that, and what's fun about them too is that when they the minute they come out of said fryer or out of the oven, you want to eat them immediately too. So you tend to also burn your mouth a lot. And so summer just turns into a whole you're talking like this a lot and you're just burned with deliciousness.
Let's talk about fried chicken. There are so many different methods that people have. Have you sort of perfected yours?
You know what? Perfection is a tough term. So I'm never going to say that I think that the I love the way that I do it, and I think it's absolutely delicious. Is it perfect? I mean, it really depends on what you're looking for out of your fried chicken.
What were you looking for when you developed
yours? I was
yours?
Looking – two things. I was looking for fall off the bone because my problem with fried chicken is always that it takes – you know, when you're cooking it, if you don't cook it for long enough, it's kind of chewy. Also, I was looking for expedience because at the Foundry, we've got like one little tabletop fryer, and I didn't have time – to cook my fried chicken long enough that it would take to cook it so that it falls off the bone. So we reached a conundrum.
And how did you solve that conundrum?
Duh. We confit it in duck fat first.
Describe what confiting is.
Now, confiting is an old school French method. Basically means cooking slowly in its own fat. The most typical thing that is confit in this world is duck legs. You know, my friend Brent always told me anything you do with an apple, you can do with a pear. So anything you do with a duck leg, you do with the chicken leg. You start off the day before, you season the leg. It's like a cure. It's like, you know, two parts salt, one part sugar, a couple different spices here and there, maybe some caraway, maybe some allspice. Season it up, let it sit overnight. It kind of releases some of its moisture. And then we put it in duck fat, drop it in the duck fat, and then bring that duck fat up to like a simmer. I basically just fill it up at room temp, and I throw it in a 275-degree oven. And we cook it for about 2 hours. So basically at the end of the day, what I'm doing is I'm pre-cooking my chicken.
But in a way to make the flesh be incredibly velvety.
It's velvety and juicy and rich and unctuous and just delicious. And then we let it cool so that it, you know, solidifies again, shall we say. Because at this point, it's like blah, 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 yeah. You know, one of those things. We let it cool. Dip it in buttermilk real quick. Double dredge. So it's buttermilk, dredge.
And you dredge in flour?
Seasoned flour. We throw a little mustard powder in there. We throw a little curry powder in there. We throw the MRPs, as we call it, at the Foundry, which are mysterious red powders because they're not always labeled, but we just know that it's either paprika or chili powder. It'll work. Quick fry it, which is fun because then you can fry it at a higher temperature.
That's really smart because then you can get a really shattering crust.
Yeah, exactly. You get a shattering, thin, delicious, crunchy crust, and the meat just, like I said, you take the leg bone and just pop it right out. People are like, oh, my God, how do you do that?
Yum.
And then you got to serve it with waffles.
Okay, so waffles. Yeast?
Unyeasted goat cheese waffles is what we do. We make a standard waffle mix. We melt some goat cheese in a double boiler, fold it into the waffle, a little tarragon.
And then do you serve it with syrup?
Of course. Syrup and a handy wipe. Here's the deal. I am not nearly the classy person that my restaurant seeks. And so any chance that I can to kind of mix it up a little bit and do things like throw in a handy wipe, I'm going to go ahead and do that.
The interesting thing about the technique of confiting is it's actually really, really easy to do at home. Most people probably think, oh, that's something. It's a restaurant thing. I can't do it. But so the hardest thing is getting the amount of duck fat you need.
Well, and you these days you can go to – you know, like a Lindy and Grundy. And the reality is, look, confiting, at the end of the day, what was it for? It was for preserving. So is it a big, tenuous process to go through to make one batch of fried chicken? Yes. Can you get a whole bunch of legs and do it one afternoon and just put it? I mean, at the end of the day, the oven does the work. So once you put it in the oven, you're not doing anything. So let the oven roll, and you can take them and literally let them cool in the fat.
Oh, that's the best way.
And that'll keep it preserved. So you can use those legs for weeks, you know? I mean, probably not, but you could take them out and freeze them and then so that you always have them ready. So it sounds like an arduous process when you're doing it dish by dish. But if you make it a project, divvy it up, put some in the freezer, put it in the fridge.
I had the easiest Thanksgiving ever last year because I decided to confit the legs.
Yeah, my turkey is confit leg meat and butter poached breast. You know, it's so often we get caught up in traditional methods of doing things and like here's how you cook a turkey, here's how you fry a chicken, here's how you do it. And that just never settles well with me. I'm always one to question. And I think by asking those questions, you go, well, what are you really looking for? you can find some really unique and great ways that really usually wind up saving you time and effort and shock you as to why the world has not come up with that idea before you.
So much fun. Thank you, Eric.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Eric Greenspan is the chef owner at the Foundry on Melrose. For the third year in a row, Eric Greenspan will be a judge at our annual Good Food Pie Contest. It's on September 18th at LACMA. It's free and open to the public. All summer long, we're celebrating pie on the Good Food blog and in our special bonus podcast, The Piecast. If you subscribe to the Good Food Podcast, you automatically get The Piecast. You can also listen on demand on KCRW's app for the iPhone or Android. Coming up, where to eat lunch, the best midday meals for under 10 bucks, and fracking, what that is and how it affects what we eat. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. As natural resources begin to deplete on our planet, companies that trade in highly valued resources will naturally turn to different technologies to exploit what's available. The most important natural resource, fresh water, for drinking and irrigation of farmland, is often involved in these new technologies, so public pushback isn't surprising, such is the case with hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica joins me. Describe what hydraulic fracturing or fracking is.
Hydraulic fracturing is a process by which thousands of gallons, sometimes millions of gallons of water, chemicals, and sand mixed together are pumped underground into a drilled well under enormous pressure to deep geologic depth so that they can fracture and break apart the rock and free up trapped bubbles of gas so that they can flow back out.
What are the environmental ramifications of fracking?
Well, we've been looking at this for the past couple of years, and the environmental risks, at least, are several-fold and still need to be evaluated. There's unanswered questions about what happens deep underground as you both break up the rock and as you put a whole bunch of toxic chemicals down underneath aquifers and deep into the ground. It's also not clear what the risks are from the disposal of those fluids, hazardous fluids on the surface, both after they're used, when they need to be either treated and reintroduced into water supplies or otherwise disposed of, or as they're handled before injection and they're brought to a well site and mixed and transported in lots of different ways. There's all sorts of spill risks there.
You know, it's just fascinating to me because when we think about how water sources are becoming more and more depleted and people talking about water as the new oil in the future in terms of its rarity, scarcity, and expense, one thinks that experimenting with chemicals and fracturing underground near sources of potable water would be just asking for a lot of problems.
Yeah, there's certainly some good questions to be raised there, especially in western states where the water scarcity is more acute. There's a convergence of issues around the necessity for energy production and the shortages of water, and they're starting to cross and become real hotspots in places like Texas, especially where you have a severe drought now, and yet they're still injecting hundreds of thousands of millions, in some cases, of gallons of fluid underground for fracturing. So there's really, like we said, both the risks to the potential underground sources of drinking water, as well as just questions about whether it's appropriate to use that much water for that purpose in the first place.
There's a scene in the documentary Gasland in which a resident holds a lighter to his running tap water, and it goes pretty dramatically on fire. How is water that has that much gas considered safe to drink?
Well, it's kind of interesting. One of the side effects that we are seeing or we're hearing reports of across the country in Colorado and Pennsylvania and Texas and elsewhere is that the fracturing may have allowed, or some part of the drilling process has allowed, methane to seep underground and wind up in people's drinking water. And that's where you see that that image of a tap be lit on fire. Methane, which is the gas that's leaking out, is not considered harmful to drink by the federal government. The risk is of course, of explosion, and if you're in a high enough area of concentration of asphyxiation, but it's not believed in modest quantities to be dangerous to ingest. However, again, there's a real dearth of science. There's been no studies of what, for example, the long-range impacts are of having a steady diet that includes a small amount of methane.
Describe some of the other chemicals that are released during the fracking process.
Well, I mean, there's many. It's not clear what's released, but many that are used, hydrocarbons in particular, what they call diesel range organics, have been detected in water contamination in central Colorado. That could come from diesel fuel, which is occasionally used and used to more frequently be used in hydraulic fracturing. It could come from the oil or gas that's being produced from underground or other hydrocarbons used in the drilling processes. There's another chemical that's gotten a lot of attention that's called 2-butoxyethanol, and it's used as what they call a surfactant in the fracking process. It's also a little bit difficult to tie with certainty to drilling because it's also used in some household cleaners and some other products. But 2-BE, as it's referred to, has also been found both in Colorado well water and in Wyoming well water, in places where residents have complained of contamination from drilling.
What about the relationship of fracking and farming? Are plants and livestock being affected by contaminated water?
Well, again, it's a good question and not one that there's clear answers to. By nature of the process, the drilling often is happening in rural areas, in those same places where farming is happening or where livestock are kept. There are a number of reports of livestock being harmed in New Orleans, in Louisiana, there was a case where 16 cattle died at a Chesapeake Energy well after drinking some fracking fluid that was spilled. Less dramatic and blatant than that, there's numerous reports around Pennsylvania and Colorado of animals mysteriously dying, of stillbirths, of other complications. It's very difficult to tie these directly to any part of the drilling process, for sure. But here you have farms that where owners say that their animals have always been healthy for several generations of farming, and it's only been after the drilling is introduced that they've noticed any difference in the health of their animals.
What about people? Are there anecdotal stories about people not feeling well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anywhere where the drilling is happening with any degree of intensity, there are numerous and common complaints of health effects. Again, almost impossible to link them with any sort of epidemiological certainty to the drilling, but the anecdotal stories are there. People complain of respiratory problems, of intense chemical sensitivity. They have skin lesions, intense headaches, sometimes nausea, and often these symptoms act up or flare up as an intense drilling activity in close proximity acts up or flares up. For example, they'll have intense headaches or skin lesions erupt within a couple of hours of fracking happening a couple hundred feet away.
How long has fracking been going on?
Well, in some form, the industry likes to point out it's been happening since the 1950s when Halliburton was the first to apply it commercially. But the technology's changed dramatically just in the last couple of years. The use of chemicals has changed, the volume of fluids has changed, and the way that it's used and the depths to which it's used underground are all dramatically different. So it's really since about 1995, 1996 that the current form has been used, and the frequency with which it's been applied has increased dramatically just in the last 10 years or so.
Where has the regulation been, especially in terms to our water supply? It seems that the EPA should be looking at anything that's pumped into our water supply.
Well, the EPA, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, normally has the authority to and does regulate anything that is injected underground for disposal purposes. In 2005, Congress passed, as part of the Energy Policy Act, an exemption that said that the EPA couldn't consider the hydraulic fracturing process as a form of underground injection, even though that's essentially what it is. So for all intents and purposes, the hydraulic fracturing process itself is exempted from EPA oversight under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It remains possible for it to be regulated and is occasionally regulated at the state level to differing degrees in different locations. And there are other aspects of federal environmental laws that apply to all sorts of drilling processes and other parts of the drilling process besides fracturing. But that particular loophole has made it hard for the feds to really get a handle on what's happening with fracturing itself.
So currently, is either the EPA or the FDA looking into the cases of contaminated water and livestock?
Well, I've heard nothing about FDA involvement or inquiries into this issue at all. It could be that that's happening, but not that I've heard. The EPA, on the other hand, in response to some of the controversy that's erupted over the last year or two, is undertaken a national study, the first real national study that it has undertaken, and it will finish that sometime in late 2012, and they're looking at what they call the life cycle impacts of hydraulic fracturing. So that means that they'll investigate complaints of contamination. They'll look at not only the actual act of injecting under high pressure, but how those fluids are handled in transport to a drilling site and how they're disposed of after they're used in the drilling and fracturing process.
Thank you so much. Really, really fascinating subject.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Abram Lustgarten comes to us from ProPublica, where he's been covering the issues associated with hydraulic fracturing or fracking. You know how it is. You don't want to have one more meal at your desk. But you got to eat. You got to go out for lunch. Where do you go? Well, this is why we have Zach Brooks from Midtown Lunch to come and tell us where to go for lunch.
I will only spend $10 on lunch. I feel like it's everybody's inalienable right to get lunch near their work, something good and unique and different, but under 10 bucks. So all my friends are like, yeah, but this place is so good, it's $12. No, can't do it. It's got to be under $10.
So where are we going for lunch? What are some places that you found recently you want to share with us?
Sure. So one of my favorite new places is downtown. Downtown is actually one of my favorite places to eat lunch. It's amazing. It's kind of exploding, not just with the nice restaurants for dinner, but also with lunch places, too.
I guess it's good you're only spending $10 for lunch since you have to park your car.
So my favorite new place in downtown is Spice Table, which is in Little Tokyo, which is this newish, like, Vietnamese-ish kind of place, and they just started serving lunch. They started this lunch menu in April that has a bunch of banh mi's. And they're a little on the pricey side for banh mi, especially being so close to Chinatown. They're in like the $7 to $9 range.
We should say that banh mi's are the famous Vietnamese sandwich.
Yes. And but the bread, they bake the bread fresh in-house. It's amazing. And their cold-cut banh mi is one of the best I've ever had. $7.50. It's kind of expensive, but worth it for the high quality stuff.
So where else?
Koreatown is another one of my favorites. I'm a huge fan of the all-you-can-eat Korean barbecue places.
Describe how to approach one of those places.
Well, it's, you know, usually you pay like $16, $18, and they'll bring you all sorts of meats, and then you grill the meats at the table, and then they have all the little banchan and everything. And you pretty much can just eat as much of the meat as you possibly can. But for lunchtime, a lot of the places will offer $10 all-you-can-eat specials. So you're not going to get as much of an array of meats, but most places will give you like pork belly and the little thinly sliced brisket for $10, and you get all the banchan, and it's kind of a great deal. But, you know, the quality for $10 isn't going to be as great as if you spend $17 or $18. But I recently was introduced by a couple friends to this newer place called Donde, which is on 3rd and Hobart. And at dinner time, I think their all-you-can-eat is like $18 to $20. But their lunchtime is only $10. And they not only give you the pork belly and the brisket, but they also give you beef belly, marinated chicken, spicy pork, Boston butt. So they give you like six different kinds of meats. And the quality is actually really good for $10. And I kind of feel like The only reason they're doing it is because there's not a lot of people there for lunch. It's packed at dinner time.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. What about in my neighborhood, Mid-City?
Oh, one of my new favorite places in Mid-City is this place called Flavors of Belize. Another place that's like practically empty at lunchtime, and you walk in and the food is so amazing. I'm not very familiar with Belizean food. Do you know a lot about it?
I haven't had a lot of exposure to it, but I'm hearing more and more about it lately. Where is Flavors of Belize?
It's on La Brea, just north of San Vicente. You know that little like motel with the little like the cul-de-sac kind of thing that branches off from La Brea right in front of the motel? I don't know, just north of San Vicente.
Yeah, that's the street I live on.
Yeah, if you drive by it, but you would never know. In that motel is this amazing Belizean restaurant.
Are you kidding me?
I read about it in the LA Times. You would never know. You drive by this motel a million times, and you would never know it's there, like, unless you really, like, looked. It's at the bottom of the motel. And they do this escabeche, which I didn't really know a ton about. It's not like ceviche or Jamaican escabeche, which is I guess it's kind of similar to the Jamaican escabeche, but it's this soup with a roasted chicken inside and all these onions, and it's got this like lemony broth. It's just amazing.
Let's go to the Lux area. Let's go to Beverly Hills.
Beverly Hills, yeah. It's tough to find,
it's such a weird place.
It's tough to find my kind of lunches in Beverly
of
Hills,
course.
Like that unique. Brooklyn Water Bagel Company just opened this kind of chain, this nationwide chain, which there's a lot to hate about it. It's the whole Larry King endorsed like bagel chain or whatever.
But is this like Brooklyn Bakery, like the great bagels
in
LA?
No. It's called Brooklyn Water Bagel Company. And they've got like wraps and like pizza bagels and all. It's like this. It's horrible. It is absolutely horrible. But the bagels are actually kind of good, like the bagels themselves. So if you can kind of ignore everything else, the bagels at this place are awesome. And if you're an iced coffee fanatic, they do iced coffee ice cubes.
Okay, Culver City.
Oh, Culver City. I live in Culver City, so I do a lot of my lunching around there. And I found this little place on Washington Boulevard. It says like Halal Market on the outside. It is the crummiest, grossest looking place you've ever driven by. You would never imagine that there was a restaurant or anything inside. It looks like a rundown, abandoned like storefront. But it's two blocks away from this mosque. And they do halal Pakistani food like biryani and chicken pulao, lamb pulao, and the best tandoori chicken I have ever eaten in my life. And they're only open weird hours because they entirely cater to people praying at this mosque. So they're only open like Thursday nights. And then like Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, kind of around prayer time. So for lunch, they don't actually open till like 12:30, 1 o'clock, because I think the services get out at 2. But you can get there at 1 before services get out, and they'll happily serve anybody. And it is honestly like probably the best. I mean, it's the best biryani chicken tandoori I have ever had in my life. Like it is just and out of the strangest, like, little place you've ever seen.
An unlikely facade.
Incredibly unlikely. I don't think I could do justice how strange and unappealing the outside of this place looks. So you just would have no idea that inside they're making this amazing food.
That's why we need people like you, Zach. Now, what about West L.A.?
West L.A., have you had sanjak?
Yes.
The Persian bread that, right, so which you can go. There are plenty of places up in, like, the valley that you can get, you know, these fresh-baked, like, 6-foot-long, like, you know, pieces of flatbread, like, freshly baked out of the oven. So they just – there's this place just opened up on Santa Monica in West L.A. called Naan Hut that does fresh-baked sanjak, just like they have the giant, like, circular oven, and they're making it fresh, and you've got – you have to push your way through, like, a group of Persian ladies, like, yelling for their fresh bread and, like – you know, and they do it. It's $3 for these incredibly long. And, you know, for people that that live or work, you know, in Santa Monica or the West Side or even parts south, you know, we always had to travel all the way up, you know, to the valley to get this amazing bread. And now there's this great place in West LA that has it.
Is it just a bakery or do they make it into sandwiches?
So they actually do have, I mean, it's primarily a bakery, but they do a lot of catering and you can get kebabs and things, you know, for under $10. You can get a couple kebabs plus the bread, which I've had and is great, you know, for lunch.
Yum. Okay, we have to go to Westwood.
So Westwood, another place that's kind of empty at lunch. Have you ever been to Wakasan?
No, I haven't.
So Wakasan's, it's been around for years. It's this great place on Westwood that previously was only open for dinner. They're kind of like a omakase kaiseki type of place. It's the kind of place that they do a little bit of sushi plus a little bit of cooked dishes, and it's all chef's choice. But as a value, it's amazing. It's only like, I think the base omakase is like $35. And the food is just, I don't know, it's just really great, like for a value place. And they just started doing lunch a couple months ago, which was kind of huge. And they do these little bento boxes for like $9 to $12 that, you know, while might be a little pricey, like I said, $12 is kind of a little out of my range. For this quality of cooking, it's just as great a value as the dinner. And it's kind of a thing that not a lot of people know that they're open for lunch yet. And they also do ramen as well.
Zach Brooks writes the blog Midtown Lunch. A list of the spots Zach mentioned are at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back with a restaurant recommendation in Orange County. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. I'm so pleased now to be joined by Gustavo Arellano. He's an Orange County resident and the managing editor for the OC Weekly. He's here to take us out to eat.
We're going to the city of Lake Forest, right next to the El Toro Y, and we're going to eat at Chili Chutney.
Chili Chutney. What kind of food is this?
Chili Chutney is an Afghan restaurant, I think there's three or four Afghan restaurants left in Orange County, and it's in the strip mall. Don't be scared, folks. There's going to be a lot of day laborers around the area because it's right next to a hardware store. They're going to leave you alone. They're fine. So you walk in there, five or six tables maybe, usually manned by the woman who owns the place and also cooks the place. She'll come in. She'll greet you. Whatever you order, it starts off with a little bowl of ash. Or aush, I guess, which if you know your Persian soup, it's basically that Persian soup aush with noodles. You know, you have the noodles, you have the sour cream or the yogurt specifically mixed in there. But what I love about this soup, it has this really strong mint flavor. You don't really expect it. I don't expect my mint in soup ever. That's just me. I like, you know, as a tea, sure, on meats maybe, but in a soup, no, it just jumps out at you really fresh and verdant and fragrant.
Mm, yummy.
And that's the starter. You know, no matter what you order, that's what's going to start off every meal. And then Afghan food, you think of Afghan food, it's at the crossroads of civilization. So you get influences from India, influences from Persia, of course, influences from the western region of China, all sorts of influences, all the different cultures that it's amassed over thousands of years. Afghan cuisine's most famous for their rice, the Kabuli Palau, which is basically, again, lamb, spices, basmati rice, and then they garnish it with slivers of carrots and raisins. I love rice. It's amazing. You should get that dish once. But the best dish there, I think these are the world's greatest dumplings, is mantou.
Mantou are really delicious.
Oh, my God. You know, I think of mantou, I think of the Korean mandu, but they're not alike at all. It's only, you know, phonetically. But mantous, the casing around, to me, they're like incomplete dumplings, because if you get a plate of mantou, you're going to have these dumplings. It's a really sheer case, very, very thin, but they're not like little balls. They're almost like spread out, almost like, oh gosh, like a big, fat, long pierogi, almost like lasagna. You have this dish of ground beef casing in the dumplings. It's covered with a meat sauce. It's covered with yogurt, really strong Afghan-style yogurt. And if you want more yogurt, they have some on the side. And it reminds me of picadillo because, you know, mantou is made with ground beef. So, but this ground beef has more cinnamon in it, has more a little bit more spices. It's a bit sweeter. And then you start eating it up with a fork. You get the casing. That's nice and gummy and chewy. And then,
yeah, by casing, you mean the pasta, right?
Yeah, the pasta itself. It doesn't remind me of the usual dumplings that I would have. Because, again, it almost seems like they started doing it halfway, but then they're like, eh, whatever. It's already going to be amazing, so why bother with any more work? And then you start eating it. You have to eat it almost with a spoon instead of a fork because the mantou themselves, the dumplings, are so delicate, they almost start dissipating right in front of you.
Then they also make those amazing little dumplings filled with leeks,
don't
they?
Oh, my God.
The ashak.
The ashak, yeah. That it's basically, again, you have that sort of dumpling, really sheer casing. I love the casings here, the wrapper, if you will. It's really just, you could almost, if you put it up in the sun, you could almost look right through it. And with the leeks, they really do good things with leeks here. The leek is really strong. They stuff it in there. They have a bread called balani. Yeah, let's just call it balani. A leek balani, which is basically, it's going to be like naan, stuffed naan. But this time it's stuffed with leeks inside of it. They toast it to its life, nice and crispy, almost black. And they have chives in there, cilantro in there. What I like to do, you're the leek balani. You start ripping up into shreds, and then you just pick up the mantou like that. You almost eat it. It's Afghan tacos. It's Afghan mini taquitos, Afghan taquitos, right? Except without the rolled stuff. Also, so good.
So good. What about salads?
Salads, well, I mean, not much in salad. You do want to order a side of what's called banjan burani, which is eggplant nearly caramelized. You know, they chop up the eggplant, put in bell peppers and onions, and then they just start cooking it, reducing it. Not as far as baba ganoush because they don't mix it up with tahini sauce or anything else like that, but just really brown, really caramelized, really smoky. And then the most important thing, no matter what you're eating, you want to order extra sides of their chutneys. They make some of the best chutneys I've ever had. They're so good. They actually bottle them and they sell it. You know, they're not pushy in terms of selling their chutney, but you'll see it, or you'll see the chutney, you'll start eating it. They have a green chutney, which is made with jalapenos, really good. But the red chutney, I have to say, I've never tasted anything like it. It reminds me of like pimiento peppers. It's like that really cherry red, very sweet quality to it, but it'll burn you. It'll absolutely burn you. So you're dunking in your balani, you're throwing it over the mantou, you're sweating, you're drinking water or doog, you know, homemade doog as well, the yogurt drink. And then you keep asking them like, oh, this is really good chutney. And she'll mention, oh yeah, we have some for sale. And you have to go and take a bottle for yourself. And this nice, nice big bottle for $7. You have to get that as well.
You've made me extremely hungry.
Well, that's what we're supposed to do here.
Thank you so much.
Gracias.
I've been talking to Gustavo Arellano, managing editor of the OC Weekly. We've been talking about chili chutney on Geronimo and El Toro in Lake Forest. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood or from iTunes. Find the show on demand on KCRW's app for the iPhone or the Android. Today's show was produced and edited by Harriet Ells and Jillian Ferguson. Candace Moyer and Lara Garcia are our segment producers. Thanks so much to Ronnie Mickelson, Taryn Olson, Becky Gephardt, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.